Which one?
I'm going to call the Property and Local Sales Tax Division to order, and we are ready. We're in a festive mood today. We have celebrating a birthday party here at 10:30, the red, white, and blue balloons, and we are going to start with Representative Cole's bill. And do I hear a motion to move House File 2768 for possible inclusion? All right, Representative Detmer moves that bill. Welcome, Representative Coles, and you have an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to put that on first?
If Representative Detmer or somebody else would be willing to offer that, that would put the bill in the shape I'd like to present it in.
I'll offer A1 amendment.
Very good. Representative Detmer offers the A1 amendment. And, you know, we do have a quorum. Very good. So we can do official business. Would you like to go ahead and explain the bill with the amendment, Representative Coles?
Is the amendment on, Mr. Chair, or do we need to...
Very good. We better vote on that. I'm so excited today.
I'm excited too, Mr. Chair.
We will vote on the amendment, the A1 amendment to 2768. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Please
Thank
proceed.
You very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and members, this bill was brought forward to me by a constituent who happens to be the brother of Senator Claire Roebling. He's actually a member of the local Soil and Water Conservation Board and is concerned about the fact that on our property tax statements there is presently an itemization of other. And he brought forward the issue, and as he explained it to me, and as he explained it to Senator Roebling, who has moved this bill, I believe it's in, I believe that Senator Bach has laid it over for possible inclusion in one of his bills. The analogy is like this: if you went to the brought your car to the auto mechanic, and you got a bill that said, "Well, we changed the oil; it's $35, and we did this to your battery, and it's $82, and we changed your windshield wipers, and that's $24, and we fixed your brakes; that's $112," and then there was a line that said "other," $175. You probably wouldn't pay that bill. At least not until you figured out what that other was. And so, Mr. Chair, what the bill does is it would require local taxing authorities to have their levy listed on the property tax statement. In the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions, as I understand it, and Ms. Baker, I hope, would correct me if I'm wrong, that would probably be another line or two on the property tax statement. In most jurisdictions, it's a economic development authority and probably a watershed or some other water authority. There may be some situations where there would be more than a couple lines listed, but in any event, we should make sure that taxpayers understand what their property taxes are going toward, what they are paying for, so that they can ask the questions, and they shouldn't have to ask what's other and then find out it's this, that, and the other thing. So it's a fairly simple proposal, Mr. Chair. I hope that you will be willing to consider it favorably as you put together your omnibus bill, and I would stand for any questions that members would have.
Well, Representative Coles, I appreciate that. One of the first bills that I ever got all the way through to law was a bill like this where it added lake improvement districts under counties. And Chair Abrams liked that and put it into the bill. And I don't know if there's been one since, have there been many lines added to the tax statement since. I know at the time the one concern, and maybe someone will testify to this, is there gets to be so many lines and whether or not there's room for it. But I totally agree with you, Representative Coles. This is a transparency, accountability issue. Huge. And you make up a great point. If you had any, you know, sort of a bill that had other and listed 100 and whatever it is, you would be asking questions.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate the concerns that that the counties may have. I believe it's my understanding from Senator Roebling that they didn't testify necessarily in opposition to her bill in the Senate Tax Committee. They raised the same concern that you're raising, that we don't want to run into a situation where we have to add a second page to the tax form. I agree with that completely. If that is, in fact, a problem, let's figure out how we can deal with that. But let's try to bring some more transparency for property taxpayers so they understand what their tax dollars are going to fund.
Representative Coles, when it comes to property taxes, I would rather have too much information than too little. Any comments for Representative Coles' bills? Any testifiers for or against? Other than me? All right. I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, Jason Nord from the Department of Revenue. And since you had mentioned the issue of the space on the tax statement, I thought I'd just chime in to just kind of agree that I think everybody likes the intent of the bill and thinks that it's reasonable to show, you know, the itemization of the different districts. It just becomes, it's hard to technically deal with the limited amount of space on the bill. So I don't think anybody's opposed to the bill. It's just going to take some work to get it figured out. But I think both the counties and the department are willing to give it our best shot. Maybe something to potentially think about, and I haven't given this a lot of thought, is maybe just delaying the effective date a little bit to give us some time to work it out. But there's just space issues with the size of the stubs and where the address has to be for the window on the envelope and a lot of different technical things to work out. So.
Well, Mr. Nord, I appreciate that, those comments, and willing to work with that. So,
in response to Mr. Nord, and I appreciate the department's willingness. You know, we've got some really smart people at our counties. We've got some smart people at the Department of Revenue. We can figure this out. If, in fact, it is going to be not possible to do immediately, then, you know, let's talk about a delayed effective date. I think that we can probably figure out a way to do that. I don't want to sit here and negotiate against myself, Mr. Chair, I do think that this is an important piece of transparency. Let's you know, put our heads together, figure out how to do this, and do it as quickly as possible, you know, recognizing that this is going to create an issue, a challenge for the department and counties to figure out how they're going to put it together. But again, there's smart people, good people who can do this. I appreciate the department's willingness to work on it.
Thank you very much. Representative Detmer renews his motion to lay over House File 2768 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you so much.
Thank
another
you,
division.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Representative Loon, are you? All right, we are going to move to House File 3638, Representative Loon, and do we have someone who wants to put that on? Representative Detmer moves.
Yes, I do. I move.
House File 3638 for possible inclusion, and we also have an amendment. Representative Detmer, would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move DE1 amendment.
Representative Detmer moves the DE1 amendment. Any discussion on that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Representative Loon, welcome, and I have to say, she has brought donuts. This is her first time. This is a festive day. And I've also declared it a no-calorie day, as Representative Loon requested. This is a no-calorie day all day here in this division. So, Representative Mulray, you can pass those around if you want to start those. So. All right, Representative Loon.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I did debate on the donuts because I know you're going to be having cake to celebrate the property tax relief program's birthday here after the committee. But, you know, on the theory that more is more, I decided we would bring donuts. So, anyway, I thank you, and I thank the members. House File 3638 is a bill that simply calls for a study of the fiscal disparities program. And I know perhaps this similar legislation has been introduced in the past, but we've made some refinements, I think, and tried to sort of narrow the scope of the study a little bit, and in meetings with the Department of Revenue and House research staff as well, to try to get our arms around something that could, in fact, perhaps be done and produce some good information for the legislature to look at this program. As you all probably know, this was created back in 1971, sort of a tax redistribution program involving the commercial industrial tax base in the 7-county metro area. And there really hasn't been any significant changes to that program since that time, despite the fact that I think we would all acknowledge the metro area looks very different than it did back in 1971, and just a lot of changes in terms of the tax base and our property tax system since that time. So again, very simply, the bill would take $100,000, and I'm proposing that we take that out of the pool, out of the distribution pool. It would equate to a very small amount. It's 0.03% of the distribution, so 0.3%. So it should have really a minimal impact. And I know Chair Lincheski and I have talked about this. I'm not so sure if that's her preferred method, but again, understanding our fiscal restraints and that, I felt that perhaps that was the most responsible place from which to take the money to do the study. And I just think as a matter of good government, it's important that we have a look back at these programs. Again, we haven't had a comprehensive, thorough study of the program to see if it's met sort of the guidelines and purposes of the program as outlined in the statute from 1971. So we look at things such as how has the program affected the variability of property tax across the region, and what are the extents of the benefits of the economic growth from the region that perhaps have resulted from that program. What impact does this have on the homestead property tax burdens across the various jurisdictions of the region? The relationship between the impact of the program and the overburden on jurisdictions containing properties that provide regional benefits, and specifically the costs of those properties that they impose on their host jurisdiction in excess of their tax payments. And it also, I think perhaps more importantly, is how does this program interact with other property tax relief, aid, or other local distribution programs we have. I have a couple of documents which I asked the pages to send around, and one is a chart that shows kind of our various property tax aids and credits programs, LGA, PTR, fiscal disparities, and it gives you a snapshot of a window of time. And if you look at the current year, fiscal disparities is the second program in line in terms of number of dollars within it. LGA is first, fiscal disparities right behind it. If you look to fiscal year 2010, you'll see that fiscal disparities actually moves up and is, in terms of dollars involved, the highest or most expensive, I'll use that term, program in terms of tax dollar distribution. So I thought that was important to note. The other thing I wanted to share, and I spent a lot of time talking with my city about it, and I'm pleased to have our Mayor Phil Young, who will be testifying in a moment, but a city like Eden Prairie, a good portion, and again, our city was largely developed beyond the 1971, so all of that growth in our CI tax base is largely subject to fiscal disparities. Things that were the growth up through 1971 was sort of off the tax base, if you will, for fiscal disparities being a suburb that developed after that. It's all in the pool. And if you will see, that's an actual property tax bill from a business in Eden Prairie, and the highest or biggest component of that property tax statement is the fiscal disparities. Far beyond what goes to the state and the state property tax portion, beyond the city and beyond the county. So I just think that's a good example of you know, what happens to business in some cities, and for you to kind of see the impact of that. So I very much appreciate the committee's consideration, and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I think we'll hear from the testifier first, if that's fine. Yes. Mayor Young, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to share some...
If you would please state your name, please.
Phil Young, I'm your testifying in support of Representative Bloom's bill.
Thank you.
We do, and the City of Eden Prairie does support the proposed bill, again, largely because, as Representative Bloom indicated, the program has been in place and in operation for almost 35 years, and a lot has changed since that time, but the program hasn't. In fact, the property tax system has undergone some substantial changes since 1975. The way that education is funded has changed. County and local government aid reform has taken place since that time. There's been class rate compression, not only for commercial industrial properties, but also for residential properties. There's a new statewide commercial industrial levy, which was imposed since fiscal disparities began. And further, in 1971, when the program was passed, you did not have cities making regional transportation investments to the extent that they are today. And in fact, when the program began in about 1975 and was implemented, in the first year, fiscal disparities captured about 6.5% of the region's commercial industrial tax base. Today, it captures approximately 35% of that tax base. So a lot has changed. The program hasn't. We do believe it's an appropriate time to look back, to make a study, especially given the fact it's been 35 years, and I can't think of another statewide program which property tax program which has gone so far without a comprehensive study. So we do support that that portion of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments on House File 3638? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize, I missed all of Representative Loon's presentation, but I can't let this one go without a comment, as I've carried this bill numerous times, and I really want to thank Representative Loon for bringing this forward. I think the way the Property Tax Committee should think about it is, as the mayor stated, you know, there's nothing else we haven't fixed or tried to fix. Sometimes when we fix things, we make it worse. But there is no other property tax aid and credit in the whole state system that is still sitting there just as it was created without any review. I think it's really irresponsible, and I understand why it is. It's because the politics are that the overwhelming majority of the metro is a huge winner from the program, and a small subset of the metro is a loser. And so the majority, of course, is afraid of changing anything because they might lose something. And I've consistently tried, since Bloomington and Eden Prairie are the biggest, I think Bloomington is the largest now contributor, I consistently try to get my colleagues to understand you might get more in a redo. It doesn't mean you'd get something less. You might actually get more, your particular city. But I think it's a real hurdle to get people to want to change the program, and Representative Loon's just trying to study the program. I want to thank Chair Marquardt, who has included this bill a few times in his division report, and we have not been able to get the Senate to think it's a good idea. So I think we should try it again, but I do just want to be, for the record, candid and express the concern I shared with Representative Loon privately, and that is that the way the bill is paid for is a concern I have, because the money comes from fiscal disparities to make the study. And while it's a tiny amount, the reason I haven't been a big fan of that is because I don't want other legislators to start viewing fiscal disparities as a spending pool to fund things. And we've seen that before. The Mall of America thought that would be a good way to build the Mall of America. We've seen stadiums think that might be a good idea to go to that pot of money. And even though it's small, I think people need to be cautious when they think of spending any money in the pool for anything. It was spent for metropolitan livable communities once, and I think that was a mistake. But the reason why I think it's so important that we not fund it that way and not use that pot is just for members to think about it this way. If anyone suggested we should build the Mall of America or a stadium or something else the state wants or needs out of LGA, I think members would have a heart attack pretty quickly. And that's what fiscal disparities is, the same thing. It's a property tax-based equalization program. It doesn't get a lot of attention around here because there's no state funds involved. So legislators don't track it very closely, but it's huge. And it is not for buying things. It is for redistributing tax base. So I really appreciate you bringing it forward, and hopefully we can get some success out of Chair Marquardt this year and then Senator Bach. So thank you.
Very good. Anyone else have any comments? Any questions or from the audience? Yes, we have one testifier from the audience. Okay. And welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We represent 80 cities across the 7-county metro region, and I just wanted to echo our support for this bill. This is consistent with our policies, which do support a study of the fiscal disparities program. So I just wanted to echo our support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Woffler. And then
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loon. I hope that we're successful as we keep taking this up, whether it's you're the author or our representative, or Chair Lincheski is, because I do think it needs some reexamination. As I recall, it was way back when the new zoo was new. We don't even think of it as a new zoo now. It's been around for, 25, 30 years now. And the thought was that it would reduce regional competition for these kinds of things, that would spur development. And representing a community that has a significant commercial industrial base, many of it, sort of the gritty industrial sort of types of of commercial industrial. We know that having those kinds of developments within your community is sometimes a blessing, but sometimes a curse in terms of the truck traffic and the wear and tear on roads and pollution alert days and those sorts of things. And I personally think it's allowed some bedroom communities that haven't shared in that kind of economic development contribution to benefit, and I think that the goals that you've outlined here are ones that we really need to have some sense of, and I think if we are able to get this enacted into law, I think we need a robust discussion, not only about the results, but going forward, what should the goals be, and you know, what makes, when we look ahead to the next 20 years, what should partnership across communities in the metro area, or maybe beyond the metro area, be?
Representative,
thanks for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Moon. I also share in everybody's applause for bringing this forward. But I think that what this does is it begs to begs the larger question, and I think it's the question that our chair has brought up over and over and over again. What are the basic city and county services that a Minnesotan should expect out of their communities? And so I encourage our chair and this committee to continue to try to answer that question. And then a little more specifically, and Representative Loon, I don't expect you to have this information, so I'm going to ask staff for it. But do we have any sort of an overlapping chart or a spreadsheet that would show us which are the communities, the cities or counties that benefit from local government aid and then those that benefit from fiscal disparities, and how much, I would be very interested to know how much overlap is there in that. And so those two are related, and this is, we have a big day today, so I'm not going to try to merge those two philosophies. There are some cities or counties that just cannot financially, because of property wealth or lack of, provide the services that we expect all Minnesotans to benefit from. So if I could ask staff to give me some sort of some information that would demonstrate that, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, Mr. Hines, I don't know if we need the information, but I think...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dietrich, we don't have such a chart prepared, but it would be pretty easy to do, and we could do that for the next... give it to the committee soon here.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Any other questions, Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I think this is a good thing. You know, looking at the comments made by Representative Leszczewski, I can't think of a better way to use the money from the fiscal disparity for a study on fiscal disparity, I guess. And it's probably something that's been overdue. Even though the study might show some changes, we still have to make those changes in the end also. So I support this.
Thank you very much. Representative Loon, any final comments?
Well, just I wanted to thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and in particular thank Representative Leszczewski. She's been very supportive of me and helpful in bringing this forward, and I look forward to working with her on trying to find a way to fund this. Again, I do think it's appropriate to take it from the pool, but I understand and also would support your contention that we shouldn't be raiding the pool for various purposes. But again, because it's a study of the actual program, I felt it was appropriate. But I would, you know, welcome the opportunity to work with you on that. And I think Representative Dietrich and Loeffler, you also both raised really important questions. One of the things that struck me in trying to dig down and look at the history of this is that this aid is not need-based, the distribution of it. It's strictly based on whether or not you're below average or above average in the metro area with regards to your CI base. So the distribution is not based on particular needs of your city or the services in that are provided. So I think those are really excellent questions, and we'll look forward to working with the committee on this.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Thank you for the donuts, and thank you to Mayor Young for testifying. And Representative Detmer renews his motion to lay over House File 3638 as amended for possible inclusion into the division report. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are now going to move to Representative Westrum's bill 3718. And then the next bill would be Representative Owens. And then we're going to take Representative Mason's and Representative Severson's bills together. They are dealing with the same issue. We'll take those together. So that's kind of the order in which we're going to go. So do we have someone that wants to move House File 3718? Representative Lanning moves House File 3718 for possible inclusion in the division report. Welcome, Representative Westrom, and please present your bill. Oh, and he has an amendment? Do we have this?
We do have an amendment that would be preferred to just put on because it deals with concerns that were raised, and I think it cleans up the bill in the way we want it.
All right, hold on just one second here. 3718.
It's
A3. Is that
A3 amendment? No, A3.
Oh, yeah.
We're looking for an A3 amendment. It should be an A3. Here's
here they come.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment.
Representative Lanning moves the A3 amendment. And so we get this to the order in which the author would like. I'm going to any discussion on that, otherwise call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Please proceed, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I'll go through the reason for the bill, and ultimately the amendment restricts it or clarifies it a little bit further. I'm going to look to Ms. Baker. Did we take the vacant land out? Was that the final conclusion?
Ms. Baker, what does the amendment do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, yes.
Yeah, okay. And Mr. Chair, first of all, let me explain the bill, and then I just was clarifying because revenue, when we met with them, we had some discussion, and they were going to get back to us if something changed, and I hadn't heard differently. But, Mr. Chair, what this would, the purpose of this bill came from me from common friend we have and a constituent of yours and a friend of mine, and but it brought an issue to light regarding ag, the special ag homestead credit. And what this would do would allow if a farmer has land held by him or his wife or jointly by him or his wife and also has some of their ag land in a partnership or an LLC structure, it would allow them to still continue to get their home, their special ag homestead. As Ms. Baker has best explained it to me, and maybe it would be the easiest, you guys deal with this all the time, but if either scenario is holding title right now, if farmer X and Y are jointly holding their land privately, or if just farmer X holds some of it and his wife, farmer Y, holds some of the land, they still can get all of that land under the special ag homestead. If those same farmers hold it all in a partnership or an LLC, they can still get special ag homestead, either living on the land and having it contiguous or adjacent, or within the four cities or townships, which is current law. We're not changing any of that. This bill would simply say this structure, as a private holders currently gets it, the LLC or the partnership structure would get it if it's all in that structure. This bill would say if there's a combination of the two, so long as it still doesn't go over the million one exemption limit, they would still get it. And in the scenario that was brought to me, there were I don't recall 3, 4, 5 quarters of land that were all qualifying and under the $1.1 million of cap for the exemption. But as soon as this person put one of those quarters for some dealing with some estate planning into a partnership structure, an LLP, a family partnership structure, all of a sudden that quarter Nothing else changed, but that quarter now does not receive that special ag homestead. And so that's what the purpose of this bill would do, would allow for both of that. It wouldn't raise the limit or the allowance. And dealing with, Mr. Chair, I met with the representative from the Assessors Association and also a revenue a couple days ago to go through the bill just to see if there was issues. And that was what the amendment dealt with. We do not, this would only be for productive ag land. We took out the rural vacant land, and I forget, is it called 2B or?
Yeah.
I think it's 2B land. So it's just deals with 2A land. I have no problem and originally wouldn't mind keeping the 2B in, but we thought, as we discussed, it might be simpler to just limit it to the 2A land. If there's a desire to put that back in, I don't have a big issue or a problem doing that, but that isn't, that this would address the concern that was brought to my attention. And so we also cleaned up just some reference to leased land. The provisions were changing wouldn't relate to leased land. And if people have more questions on that, we can go into that. But as I understand it, it dealt with the objections or the concerns that were raised, and that's the purpose of the amendment. And the bill should be in the shape that would work best at this point in time.
Very good. Any questions from the members? Representative Woffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a person who doesn't have any ag land that I know of in my district, I'm still trying to learn this. It's all very complicated. But as I understand it, and I just want to make sure I understand the bill, is that what this does would allow a different type of ownership structure to qualify for ag homestead, and that isn't currently recognized right now, and that you mentioned, Representative Westrum, that the reason one would do this different structure is oftentimes for estate planning, which is something I'm also struggling to learn about a little bit. And so I'm just wondering if the purpose of the estate planning is to avoid estate taxes, and we're now helping encourage support that effort. I'm just not sure if staff or someone could kind of get me a better understanding.
Representative Westrum, would you mind if Ms. Baker answered that?
Yeah, I also have an answer.
Okay, we'll come with that. Ms. Baker, would you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think this bill does not grant homestead to a different entity, like you're saying. What this bill really does is it does cross over, however, by saying if you have a homestead that has not reached the full value of that first tier, and you are a member of an LLC that's within this distance, it's contiguous, and like in Representative Westrum's case, I mean, this property is right next door, that you can use up the rest of that tier. And so it is allowing that additional value to be added to get homestead. But if, in fact, you lived on that LLC, you would get full homestead on it. So we are not allowing a new type of property to receive homestead, but we are allowing this addition to be added when, you know, and because of estate planning, you know, clearly our property tax laws and the estate planning laws and income tax laws do not mesh. And it would be nice maybe if they did, because a lot of people, you know, they want their cake, they want to eat it too, if I can use that phrase.
That's but, later today.
right. But you know, they want to work out what is best for estate planning, and, you know, as a result of it, things start getting complicated, and they want to figure out, you know, how they can pass the land on to their kids with a minimum amount of taxes when they die. And some of those laws don't interact with the property tax laws, and whether or not one should look at the interaction of all that and try. Special ag homesteads are a nightmare for assessors. There's no question about it. And one thing that was put in this bill is that it's onus on the taxpayer to notify the assessor in these instances so that the assessor does not have to go out and look for these. And that was an attempt to say we're trying to at least make it more, you know, easier for the assessor to find those. But it's not granting really a new homestead, but it is giving that additional value where they would not have received it because it's a different entity.
If I may just to make sure then that I'm understanding it, and thank you, you did take me in a different direction, so I was misunderstanding it. So then, as I understand it right now, you might have an LLC or a family corporation or a partnership or some kind of other business structure that owns a chunk of property that right now is not getting egg homestead treatment. Mm-hmm. But the members now of that business entity would be able to take portions of that and add it to their egg homestead if they hadn't reached the maximum. And so then that chunk of property now would be getting egg homestead benefit, which would mean that the rest of the properties within that taxing jurisdiction would have less revenue from it, and it would shift on to the other property owners.
Yeah.
And is there a, I didn't see language that said there'd be a ceiling, so that if you had, say, six owners who potentially all had some excess capacity, and the LLC or this currently non-egg homestead property couldn't get everyone up to the max, I don't see any way of how you allocate that if there wasn't capacity. Say you had three owners who are all separate, are all brothers, let's say, and they all have their own separate egg homestead, and then they have this LLC. Mm-hmm. They'd all, of course, want the maximum benefit, but maybe there wouldn't be enough capacity for that. I mean, would there need to be some provisions for how you allocate this?
Representative Westrom?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking to Ms. Baker because she might have an answer on this as well.
Go ahead, Ms. Baker.
I think the short answer is, first of all, they're going to have to qualify under the contiguous or the four township in the first place to even qualify for the limit. So that does set the ceiling, but Ms. Baker might have more to clarify on that. I don't mean to throw you in.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler and Westrom, you know, it really doesn't matter here because keep in mind that that entity, that LLC, gets a separate tax statement, or maybe we haven't cleared that up yet. So what we're doing is we're determining how much of that LLC is going to be taxed as homestead and how much is going to be taxed as non-homestead. So if all of it is used up or if you're worried about the apportionment, you know, each of those people are members of that LLC and they're paying the bill for the property taxes as part of the expenses of the LLC. And so that property tax statement is going to, you know, John Smith, and that's who's paying the property taxes, and that's just going to be adjusted based on these owners. So I don't think that, you know, revenue will probably, if this should pass, send out some instructions on how to do this, but, you know, from a standpoint of apportioning it out, I don't think it'll matter because the tax statement is going to be of the LLCs.
Mr. Chair.
We've got about 3 more minutes on this bill. Okay. We need to move, so I'm going to go to the audience right now. Is there anyone who's got anything for or against this bill that has not already been stated up here? There's already been some concerns, so anyone? All right. Representative Loeffler, did you have more?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that yesterday we'd seen some comparisons from the Voss report that really showed how much advantage there is to ag homesteads versus other homesteads across the state. And this seems to be extending it to other business entities, and I have some reservations about that in terms of what the property tax cost shifting would be to, you know, the local hardware store in that agricultural community or the people who's just got a basic homestead in town. And so it would be interesting to know what the impacts would be in different communities.
Appreciate that. Anyone else, members? Representative Westrom. Representative Koonin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question is probably for Ms. Baker also, but let's go back to the example of three brothers that own a parcel in partnership. One of the brothers owning a separate piece of land hasn't met the maximum up to the 1.1 million or whatever it is. And this other parcel is owned in thirds. Does he and his third still doesn't get him to that 1.1? Does that extend even further into the value of land of the other brothers, or does it stop at that one third?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coonan, again, you know, it goes back to that the LLC is an entity. I mean, or it's a separate parcel there, that the property tax statement is going to be based on that particular property, whatever value is there. And so it's going to look at, you know, the one brother that hasn't reached the maximum, and let's say they're 200,000 short of that. That means 200,000 of that LLC's property is going to be valued as homestead. Now, if the other two brothers are residential homeowners and don't have, this only ties to ag-based parcels, so they wouldn't get any. It has to tie to an agricultural homestead, and so there wouldn't be any other increase or any other homestead value on that LLC except for the one that hadn't reached the maximum on the ag. And I don't know if Steve wants to add.
Mr. Hines.
Yeah, Representative Coonan, I think you were addressing whether if the member's share wasn't enough, if there was still room beyond the member's share. And our understanding from the way the Department of Revenue interprets this, and counties do it, is within the LLC, they don't attempt to break it into shares. So it could go into the full, it could just use any value in the LLC up to the 114. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That answers the question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hines just answered what I was going to point out.
Representative Westrom, any closing comments?
Chair, not much. Just to Representative Coonan, that's what I understood and learned from our meeting a couple of days ago, too. They don't currently break down what type of ownership or membership shares are in an LLC. They treat that as a structure that would qualify. It's just this bill basically connects the two structures. Both of them already qualify. It's just the two together jointly do not qualify. And to Representative Loeffler's earlier question, it wouldn't just be a state finding that I could see. Eight, 9 years ago, Representative Loeffler, LLCs couldn't be used by farmers for a structure, a business entity. And so in some cases, I could also see it being a transition to a LLC of their farming operation that a decade ago they couldn't do. And so that would be another scenario that I would see this potentially.
Thank you very much, Representative Westrom. Representative Lanning renews his motion to lay over House File 3718 as amended for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
We will move to House File 3747, Representative Owen. And Representative Coonan moves House File 3747 for possible inclusion. Any amendments to this bill?
No.
Very good. Welcome, Representative Owen, to the committee, if you would present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. This bill basically comes out of the situation dealing with the city of Thief River Falls right now and county of Pennington. What specifically it's dealing with is the airport authority that's granted by the 2008 law that was passed, which allowed for a property tax levy by an airport authority. But at the time that law was passed, it allows for a property tax levy over all the ag land. And by background, I'm going to go just a little off base for a second. In the city of Thief River Falls and surrounding area, we have several major companies. For instance, and I'll name the one that some of you have already heard used in other committees, and they've testified in other committees, DigiKey, employs over 2,000 employees, and in fact, just added, is in the process of adding 400 more since the airport hangar bill was approved, bonding bill was approved. So what's obviously happening in the city of Thief River Falls and surrounding area is that the airport, being a Thief River Falls regional airport, but really only the Thief River Falls community, has up till now paid any of the tax bill. So they've been solely responsible for the repairs and maintenance, et cetera, of the airport. Well, about a year and a half ago, the county board and the city started working on a process whereby the city and county would both pay part of the bill. In fact, this year, the county, by agreement, is paying $60,000, but not by any airport authority, just agreeing that they're, because they have several employees, obviously employed in the county, that don't live in the city limits, in the city of Thief River Falls, that they should be paying part of the bill. What this bill would do is allow the city of Thief River Falls and the county of Pennington to establish their airport authority so that they can tax only the referendum market value, not the entire ag land values, which would normally be taxed under the authority. So what you'd have is a tax on 1 acre land and garage and the house itself. And if you need a better explanation, I'll let Mr. Hines explain better. But essentially, that's what they're doing. They're trying to set up an authority that will allow the city and the county to get an airport authority together, and with the tax levy allowed under the referendum, similar to what a school district would use without a referendum. Yeah. It's similar, because in the airport authority, you have to have two-thirds members vote to approve the bill in the first place if you're going to levy. So if, let's say, you had five from each, it's going to take at least seven people of that committee to actually approve an airport levy in the first place. So basically, that's what the bill does. It tries to limit what the impact on the ag community would be, but it does also allow it to be recognized that the ag community, which has several people working in the city of Thief River Falls, whether it's DigiKey or Arctic Cat or several other industries that exist in Thief River Falls, would be accounting for part of their interest in the airport. Are there any questions?
Yeah, Representative Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Owen, I had a question that I see that that ag and cabins are exempted. Is that correct from this?
Representative Owen?
I think seasonal has to be allowed in it, as I understand, but in the Pennington County limits, to find a seasonal in rec location is an impossibility, because the county of Pennington has no actual individual lakes in the entire county.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I guess my question would be, since ag is exempted, are there any ag planes that use this particular airport?
Representative Owen.
There probably is ag planes that would use the airport, because private planes probably do fly in there. So there are some that would be using it. Basically, the big benefits are obviously from on the runway. The big benefiters are the Arctics, the DigiKeys, UPS that flies in three times a day, and FedEx, which flies in once a day. Those are your big benefiters, and at this stage, the city of Thief River Falls is paying all the bills for that airport.
Mr. Hines, when did these airports get the authority to property tax? And just, how's the law on that?
Mr. Chairman, and maybe Ms. Baker wants to help out. We just passed this airport authority legislation in 2008, okay, pretty recently.
2008.
I don't know before that what they could do before we passed the special airport legislation. That through the joint powers agreement statute generally, perhaps they could have done something somewhat similar, but I don't really know.
So in this bill, the fact that they're levying is nothing new. It's the way, or it's the tax base in which it's being levied against.
Exactly.
Okay, very good. I'm going to ask the audience, anyone for or against that would like to testify on this House file? Any closing comments, Representative Owen?
In closing, if you want a much better explanation than I gave of what's going on, read the letter from Steve Nordhagen, mayor of the city of Thief River Falls, and from Daryl Twitebot, chairman of the Pennington County Board. It'll explain in a little more detail than I did at this stage.
We have those documents, and you explained it well, too, Representative Owen. So Representative Coonan renews his motion to lay over House File 3747 for possible inclusion in the division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, if both Representative Mason and Representative Severson could come forward, and we will, Representative Detmer, would you like to move House File 2633 and move House File 3507 for possible inclusion?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair.
Very good. We have that motion, and I don't believe there's any amendments for either one. And Representative Mason, you have the lower number there, 2633, so we'll listen to your bill first, and then Representative Severson will listen to yours, and then if we have testifiers, we'll take them after both bills. So I appreciate you both being here. Representative Mason.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for hearing the bill. Last year, there were some changes made that negatively impacted disabled veterans and their spouses. And given the fact that these people are already dealing with a number of extremely difficult issues, I think it's our responsibility to help them and at least take one worry off their list. This bill extends the time for surviving spouses to receive the disabled veterans market value exclusion, and my bill just does it for the most severely impacted. I am certainly open to expanding that. And in lieu of time, I'd like to have two of my constituents give you their feelings on that. Is that
sure? Okay. Thank you, Representative Mason. Welcome so much for being here. If you would please state your name, please.
My name is Gina Fisher. I'm from Burnsville, Minnesota, and I'll just start off by saying I am completely out of my comfort zone.
Ms. Fisher, are you looking at the balloons and everything here today? I mean, I don't know if anyone's in their comfort zone today, so this is a good day here, so please proceed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Craig Fisher. I'm also a resident of Burnsville, a severely disabled veteran.
And I think I'll do most of the speaking today because I'm actually easier to understand. My husband had a stroke a couple of years ago. I wanted to be able to put a face to the spouse and to family members of severely disabled veterans. As a little bit of history, I won't go back too far, but my husband was severely wounded in 1967 in Vietnam. And we have been married, then he went along for several years, then we've been married 27 years. And when we first got married, he, of course, was severely disabled, but as a younger man at the time, he was 37 years old, he was able to go to work every day and deal with his disabilities. But as time went on, more and more of his disabilities began to impact myself. And when we first started out, he has a lot of shrapnel. He was hit by a 80-millimeter mortar that landed in the hole with him, an 82-millimeter mortar that landed in the hole with him, and it actually blew off his buttocks and it impacted, obviously, his lower back, and shrapnel all over. And periodically, that shrapnel works its way out, and sometimes it gets abscessed, so there would be these procedures once in a while to deal with that. That's when we were first married. And then as the years went on, he was working as a supervisor for the Disabled American Veterans. And it became more and more difficult for him to get the same job done in 40 hours a week. So he would work weekends, be very fatigued, come home, literally sit down in the chair and go to bed. He finally retired in 1997 because his blood pressure was just completely off the charts, and he was starting to develop severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's when my life started to change. Because of his nightmares that he has from the post-traumatic stress disorder, I was working as a court reporter at the time, and I would have to be available to and ready to go for a 10 o'clock deposition, for instance, on a Monday morning, and with his nightmares and thrashing, I just couldn't sleep with him often. And that was kind of the first signs of things. And then as we progressed through the years, he just got weaker and weaker. And you know, I've written various things here. It's difficult for me to talk about because it is so personal. I'm trying very hard not to keep it together, not cry. So it's very, very hard for me. But the biggest thing that started happening was he started falling a lot. He always had a drop foot, but he would fall. I'd come home, and sometimes I find him having fallen with the inability literally to get up. One day in particular, well, there were several days, but one day he couldn't get up, and he was behind the garage and was looking for him, and I found him back there having fallen. And because of all the medication that he has to take for the post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as for his heart and the various thing, the pain medication. Now, this is quite personal, but it is part of it. There is erectile dysfunction. And as you can imagine, that impacts our lives as well and causes, as a man, it further adds to his depression. But the way it's impacted me the most in recent years is he had a stroke 4 years ago, and after the stroke, he started getting aspirating pneumonia. And he's got this GERD, acid reflux disorder. The thing is, from all of the medication that he takes. And he would aspirate this stuff up and would go into his lungs. And 25 times he's had this pneumonia, which I'll wake up and he's got this the shaking chills. And I've got to either call 911, I've done that a couple of times, or just get him to the to the VA emergency room. And, of course, it's very difficult to try to, again, be at work at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning when he's in bed like that. So I quit court reporting several years ago, and I went to a less restrictive career on my time, which is it's called scoping. It's assisting other court reporters with their preparing their transcripts, and the pay is substantially less, but it does give me the freedom to be able to be here. I go to all of his medical appointments now. He's got confusion. He's been diagnosed with dementia, early stage dementia. So he no longer manages his own appointments and things like this. So it's become kind of almost a full-time job to be the caregiver to this man that was once sort of, he was kind of the guy that did it all and was kind of the take charge guy. It's now kind of me. I mean, I could go on and on. I maybe you get the picture. If I don't know if you have questions or you want to hear more examples, or I've got quite a laundry list here.
Ms. Fisher, I appreciate, thank you for that very personal and very effective testimony. Really do appreciate that. And Mr. Fisher, thank you for your service, and both of you for your sacrifice. You may proceed. You bet.
He's a little difficult to understand. If you're having a problem, would you please let me know, Mr. Chairman?
Very good. Mr. Fisher.
Yes.
Please proceed.
I, in fall of 1978, wrote a resolution where people that were 100% service-connected, permanently and totally disabled, would be eligible for waiver of property taxes. The reason I wrote it that way, those are the most deserving, and it costs the state of Minnesota and the cities much less to provide. Someone altered that to 70%
I think they'll meet their own needs.
Mr. Chairman, he said 1978. I think he meant 2008.
Yeah. 2008 when the House of Senate, was that, or 7? 2008 we passed that bill or that law. So, yeah, thank you.
And as far as the widows continuing to see this, it cost me a substantial a lot of money to retire early. I retired 9.5 years early. She had to quit her court reporting to help me. And I don't want to see the day come where she would be out on the street for inability to pay taxes. And This is something 100% disabled as a result of gunshot wounds or fragments. Mm-hmm. It's really an honor class. And I feel in my heart this would be the appropriate and fair way to go. That way, every city is not hearing, it wasn't for those damn veterans to hit them for some money. I think you're too wide of scope.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any comments from members here? So, thank you so much for your testimony. Really, really appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Mason, any further?
No, again, I just wanted to say that, you know, these people, through no fault of their own, are suffering some severe consequences, and I think, and my bill zeroes in on those people that I think we absolutely have a responsibility
to
help.
Thank you very much.
I'd appreciate your support.
Very good.
Thank you.
Representatives, thank you. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I think that's it's a pretty compelling testimony that we've just heard, and I think it really goes to the heart of the bill that we have before us, particularly mine. I think it, I know in Representative Mason's bill, it creates a dividing line between the age of 50 and those younger. I see a problem with that in that I think we have a large contingent of warriors who are coming back from current war on terror. And it sets them up under a separate class, which I think is probably not appropriate. I think that the testimony that you heard is experienced regardless of age. When we have a member that's served the country, has received 100% disability rating, it's for a cause that is service-related, which basically means that that individual would have, except for the fact that they were injured in the line of duty, would have had a full life and had the opportunities that each one of us has who does not serve or is not injured in battle. And those sacrifices carry on with that individual until they pass. And even more impact is the fact that the spouse is caring, just as you've seen in this instance, is caring for the individual, often making their own personal sacrifice to be able to meet the needs of that suffering veteran. And so I think it sets up a category that in this provision, and I'll add that the bill that originally went through was a bipartisan bill sponsored by Representative Eastland and by Representative Rocavina, I believe. Yeah. And it received overwhelming support, and I think the caveat that was put on it, and in its original form, it was there was no end date for the spouse. I think that was put on in conference committee, and it was unfortunate that that transpired, because I believe it puts an onerous weight on a surviving spouse who is already through the disability compensation fund. Once the veteran passes, the amount of compensation is reduced on the federal side for the surviving spouse. So now we've got that reduced compensation, and in compounding that, now we also increase the cost of their ability to stay by increasing their property tax, by getting rid of this provision, increase their property tax, so we've kind of hit them with a double whammy. And so I would encourage the committee to strongly consider House File 3507 as the solution to this problem, and I believe that I've got a couple of individuals that would like to testify to this as well.
Thank you very much. If those testifiers would come forward. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Proceed.
Welcome, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I reside in Roseville, Minnesota. I am the vice chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, which encompasses over 35 of the veterans organizations, named veterans organizations in the state of Minnesota. My friend Ted Adams is also a member of, he's a American Legion person. Between the two of us, we represent all the major organizations in the state of Minnesota, and obviously he'll talk himself. We are in favor of Representative Severson's bill. However, the 2633 that was just talked about gives me a pause, because we're disenfranchising another group of veterans, especially these Iraqi and Afghan vets, Desert Storm. And what happens is that we've got some seriously disabled veterans in that area, you know, more than 70%. And as a Vietnam veteran, and I want to thank you for your service, sir, I fortunately wasn't disabled in that war, but I have been since then with a PTSD. That stuff comes back to you like gangbusters, and I didn't realize that. However, I don't want to have that burden on us disenfranchising these Iraq vets. You know, the motto of our organization, my particular organization that I belong to, is never again will one group of veterans abandon another. And in this instance, if you put a 50-year-old age on the spouse, remember, whether it's the husband or the wife, that takes it away. And we wanted to be able to eliminate that two-year addition on there for onto it, because it just doesn't seem right. If they have a deceased veteran that's 100% or 70%, you don't get what that veteran got. It's less than 50%. If they're already in financial difficulty and they've got to pay this property tax again into it, it's just another domino in their downward financial spiral. And so we want to be able to eliminate that two-year, what would you call that, internship on this, and then have it completely to the spouse again after, until they sell that home or she remarries, or he remarries. So we would want to be able to have Representative Severson's bill, which is 3507, the one that we want to go through.
Thank you. And I want to assure all members and everyone in the audience that both of these bills provide an additional benefit to spouses of disabled veterans. So I don't really like hearing one bill being battled against the other. As a division, we're going to look at both bills.
Okay.
and we will consider both bills. But both bills are benefiting spouses of disabled veterans, and I want to make that very clear. Representative Masons is doing that, and Representative Severson. So I just hope we're not, you know, we brought them in together here, but hopefully we're not. I understand the points that are being made, but they both are better than what we have right now. So I just want to make that very clear, and that's what we're trying to do here. So, sir, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dave Adams. I'm presently the State Veterans of Foreign Wars Chief of Staff and a past state commander for the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And after your statement, Mr. Chairman, I really don't know what to say here. That other than that, the Veterans of Foreign Wars would like to go on record of supporting 3507. Respectively, and I understand that both of them are great bills, but we would support 3507.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you so much. Representative Severson, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think the real issue here is how do we get support for those spouses of surviving veterans that are 100% disabled, and in a crucial time in their lives when they're dealing with the loss of their partner, and now the finances have come to roost. They receive a reduced compensation under their disability compensation from the government. And at this point, I think I appreciate the intention of the original bill to try and take care of them so that we don't end up booting them out of their house and then putting them onto the county for aid, helping them in a time of need. And we're not here to contest this bill over the other bill. I think our real purpose here is to say let's treat a veteran as a veteran, and let's try and make sure that their spouses who have made sacrifices as a partner are considered, and we can do that with these bills. And I appreciate the committee taking the time to hear.
Thank you very much. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to thank the testifiers, and I apologize I didn't hear all of it because I was called away for roll call vote, but I know how difficult it is to speak personally in a public way, and really appreciate that testimony. It's very moving, and thank you for that. And I know that Representative Mason and Representative Severson can work this out with the chair. I think the intentions are good here by the authors. But I do want to just thank Representative Coonan and Representative Marquardt, who, you know, for the record, for folks who may not know this, you know, they've worked very diligently in support of these provisions for years here, and the House has carried these provisions. And I, you know, obviously don't know what Chair Marquardt's going to do, but my guess is he's not going to back down on this because he's been a strong advocate of these kinds of proposals. But I do want to ask Representative Severson and Mason, how are your bills by Senator Hahn and Senator Erickson Ropes doing? Because the Senate has been the holdup here. And for folks who are tracking these, they need to go tell the Senate why these are important. Because Representative Coonan and I and Loeffler and Marquardt and others have had a difficult time in conference committee to get the Senate to want to do ultimately support these bills. So we really need Senator Hahn and Senator Erickson Ropes to be successful over with the Senate. Can either of you report if they've had hearings, and do you know anything about your Senate authors?
Representative Mason, Representative Severson, how do we deal with the Senate?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Mr. Chair, because we have some people that are behind us here that are ready to influence the Senate. And they will do that in a major way. And I think just your ability, your willingness to take these bills up and hear these bills and include them, I think is going to send a major signal to the Senate. We will work our part, let me say, from that side of the House, and they will hear the voice of the people.
Thank you. Representative Mason?
And again, I really appreciate you hearing this bill. And the Senator Erickson Ropes bill will be heard tomorrow morning at 8:30. So I'm very hopeful for that, and that was the reason for my modified bill. I would prefer the 100%, but knowing that the Senate, their previous stance, that's the reason for my bill.
So, well, appreciate this, and in fact, in 2008, we thought this was a huge, important, necessary step when we did expand the property tax exemption to disabled veterans, and that was kind of step one, and we dealt a little bit with surviving spouses. Didn't, as Representative Lincheski said, we were not able to go nearly as far as we wanted. I will commit, and I think this committee will commit, to all of you that we will try to do as much as we can as we move this on, because we, the testimony was very, very effective and just very powerful, and appreciate everyone who testified today, because this is the direction we need to move. So,
Mr. Chair, thank you so much for your attention to this. Thank you for giving us the time. We will plow the ground to prepare for your negotiations.
Very good. Representative Detmer, you have some. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, again, thank you for your support. And Representative Cronin, I'm serving on your committee and the Veterans Affairs Committee. And I think we all need to realize that there's another battle going on, and that's on the home front. That when we send our men and women off to war, that we have a home front that we have to take care of here. And I know my family's been blessed that both our son came home intact, and myself too. So, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornyn, I know you serve on the Veterans Committee also. Any comments you have? Or?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in the division, these bills just, you know, there was no opposition at all, very strong support in the committee. And as Chair Lincheski has stated earlier, too, within this committee and as the House as a whole. So just to your testifiers and your supporters, do your work in the Senate. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Detmer, I believe, will renew his motion to lay over both House Files 2633 and House File 3507 for possible inclusion into the division report. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mulley, do you have any testifiers that can come back on another day? Because yours, I think, is going to take a few more minutes than what we might have time for. Is that a problem? Or I should say, I mean, I can, Mr. Bell, can you come back on another day? Or is, did you travel far? Or, okay, so you can come back next Wednesday?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, was there anyone else from out of town on the Marquardt bill, 3760, that was going to testify? All right. Representative Dietrich, do you have testifiers from today on your bill?
Yes, one testifier from Hennepin County.
And could that person come back on another day?
Yes.
All right.
Very well.
Well, why don't we then do Representative Mallory's bill? And we will have exactly 11 minutes to do Eustead's, and actually that worked out just perfect. So, and we will move the other ones to next Wednesday is when we're meeting. And thank you so much for people who are going to be here. We're just running out of time. We have dignitaries coming in at 10:30 today. We want to keep on schedule as much as we can. And there's a technical amendment here. And do we have the technical amendment?
It's A4 amendment.
Okay, well, I will.
There it is.
Here we have it. I will move. Or Representative Mulley, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the bill.
Representative Mulley moves House File 1395 for possible inclusion. We also now have the A4 amendment. Would you like to move that? Representative Mulley moves the A4 amendment. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mulley, please proceed. I see you've got Mr. Nord there to help you out, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill can take 5 minutes or 5 hours, depending on what you want.
Exactly. That's why we have 10 minutes, Representative Mulley.
Mr. Chairman, we basically have an issue of something that was set up in back in the 40s, and it just doesn't work anymore. And the department is getting into the position of having to almost manage properties and figure out what's being done out in the around the state, which is not really the Department of Revenue's job. And so they've been working for 4 years to put this together, I believe, 3 or 4 years. And now I think everybody is pretty much in agreement. Basically, the issue is when there's tax forfeited lands, the title goes back to the state, and then a city can get it, for instance, by paying full value and then giving it out, but they could also get it on what was called public purpose, and that got into whether or not a park included just vacant land that had dirt dumped on it. And so got to be an impossibility for the department to really be managing it. So they've worked on this new provisions where there's specific things for a use deed. After 30 years, it's automatically turned over. There's special conditions where you can get buy it for less than market value, for instance, blight, affordable housing, things like that, for less than the full market value. But Mr. Nord will explain the whole bill.
Mr. Nord.
Mr. Chair, members, I think you have a one-page handout. It's probably most efficient to just go through the one-page table. It's somewhat of an obscure topic, but essentially it just deals with how tax forfeited land is sold, and specifically how local governments can acquire it. And other than buying it for its full market value, the only other option is the use deed option. And that's the option is just they can receive the property for free if they pledge to put it to a specific use, and if they ever stop putting it to that use, it reverts back to the state. And as Representative Mullery said, it's a 1941 law that really hasn't been touched since, and has created a lot of problems. And the problems are summarized on the left-hand side of the chart, and our solutions are summarized on the corresponding solutions on the right-hand side. So current law assumes that we can infinitely monitor whether or not a parcel is in compliance with the use deed. So if they take it for a park, forever we have to monitor whether or not it's a park, otherwise it reverts back to the state. We're putting a 30-year limit on that, and allowing a process by which they can be exchanged earlier if they're compliant. There's also no clear intent in the law as to what authorized public uses should include, and so we've defined a more limited set of options that we think are more appropriate for the use deed mechanism. One example of those authorized uses is the parks, and we've recently had a big court case over that as to what a park is, and essentially the court ruled that if the city's charter has a definition for parks, we should use that because there's no state definition, and so that leads to pretty difficult task for us to figure out how the locals define a park. And the biggest problem is the lack of alternatives for various good purposes. And so we've created some new alternatives. A better way of dealing with blight and affordable housing and the preservation of wetlands and stormwater and keeping land in its natural state is to be able to sell it for less than market value to recognize the public good. But then they have a clean deed. It's not a use-restricted deed, and it serves those purposes much better. We also allow for conveyance of developer outlots and common interest community outlots and sliver parcels in a more efficient way. We've also addressed some of the processes in this bill. The classification process has been refined, and we also have improved the process by which local governments can request that land be withheld so that they can consider an acquisition. We also remove somewhat of a loophole that allows that if you receive a parcel for a park and you sell it for economic development purposes, we're supposed to continue to believe that the park is in existence. And so we're removing that provision. And we're addressing a number of other miscellaneous issues. But again, as Representative Mullery said, this is something we've worked on for 3 or 4 years. We've worked with all these different stakeholder groups. I think we've made most of them happy, or at the very least, I'm not aware of anybody who's opposed to the bill as it stands. And it did make its way through the Senate already and was unanimous on the Senate floor. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Nord or Representative Mullery? If not, any last words, Representative Mullery? And
no, Mr. Chairman, you can get another bill in.
No, we're not, and I know that you've worked hard on this issue. The Department of Revenue has worked hard, and I know I'm making somewhat light of it, but it's kind of mundane but very important, so I'm hoping we can straighten this out on the year. So Representative Mullery renews his motion to lay over House File 1395 for possible inclusion into the vision report. So thank you very much. Members, do we have minutes?
No.
to, we don't have minutes. We're going to adjourn here, and we're going to rearrange things for about 3 or 4 minutes, but we'll come right back here at 10:30 for celebration. We're going to leave these first four seats open for the dignitaries, so we'll have everything aligned. So thank you so much, and everyone's welcome to stay here for the birthday party. We're adjourned. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll start in about 1 minute. If you could take your seats, we have the dignitaries up front.
Comfortable seats, huh? Once in a
minute. Would you have the honors of getting the gavel to start this? Do you want to give us?
I don't want to make an end.
The speaker has called us to order. First of all, welcome everyone, honored guests, and everyone who showed up here today to celebrate the 35th birthday party of the Property Tax Refund Program. And you know, I saw an ad by the Dairy Queen, and they're celebrating 25 years of the Blizzard. And so I thought if they can celebrate 25 years of the Blizzard to help promote something, we certainly can celebrate a 35th birthday party for the Property Tax Refund Program to also get the word out and to publicize this. And also, the PTR is better for you than the Blizzard. So I want to thank everyone for being here. If you have followed this division and Tax Chair Lincheski the last couple years, you know the strong support that we have had for this program. And as you know, if you talk to the Chair Lincheski, Miss Progressive, that is one of the great things about that program. It's very progressive, but it helps people stay in their homes. It's a program that was started back in 1975, and we're going to hear from the gentlemen who were very instrumental in making this program work. But when you think back as legislators and governors, if you will, and you think about what you've accomplished, you always want to be able to look back and think about a program that helps people. And yesterday, honorary guests, we heard from the VOSS database. We had that presentation made. And Mr. Ouellette from the Department of Revenue did that. And it just reinforced how important the property tax refund program is. In fact, one statistic from yesterday was that from income from $10,000 to $30,000, it literally cut the burden, the percent of property taxes per your income, in half. It cut it in half. So this is a program, and also when I talk about the property tax refund program, I'm also talking about the renter's credit. They started the same time. In fact, we're the same program initially, and then kind of branched off. But this is a program that just really helps, as Chair Lincheski had mentioned in yesterday's meeting, how it helps seniors on fixed incomes, her parents, who moved into a home back in the late 60s, early 70s, at $18,000, I think the home was purchased for, and whatever it's purchased today, that helps them stay in their homes and young families. So this is a program that has a track record, it's survived the test of time, and it's a great attribute to those folks who made that happen back in 1975. House Research has put together, and this will be around, an excellent piece of paper there on the history of the property tax refund program. And initially it was not the property tax refund program, it was called the Income Adjusted Homestead Credit. And then 2 years later it was called the PTR. But I did find out that it was House File 1674. So I will be putting in a bill next week to retire House File 1674. I don't know how far that's going to go, but we're going to retire a bill number, and we'll see if that will work. The impact has been huge. In 2008 alone, there's 360,000 refunds, $270 million, an average of $746 a refund. Renter's credit, 304,000 refunds, $180 million, an average of
$1,591 per return. So the purpose today, and I will say that everything you see here is privately funded. There's no committee funds going into any of this, just so everyone's aware of that. But it is to give this program publicity. And I know the Department of Revenue will talk about how that works and how that plays out when you can apply. But we talk a lot about property taxes, and this helps keep property taxes down based on need, based on the ability to pay. So what I'd like to do right now before we continue our program is to introduce our dignitaries that we have today, those who were very instrumental in what happened back in 1975. We have, from 1975, the governor who signed the bill, governor and then later U.S. Senator Wendell Anderson. I will be asking all of you to make some remarks later on. We have the Speaker of the House at the time, and later Congressman Martin Sable. And we have a tax chair. We have a few of them in this room today. But we have the tax chair who was there to make that happen, Bill Kelly. And as the story goes, it always takes the Senate a little longer to come along on some of these real progressive, innovative ideas. But we do have the person who made that happen in the Senate in 1975, the president of the Senate and later Lieutenant Governor, Alec Olson. We also have the vice chair of the tax committee at the time, Bob Vanosik, who was found that one out today. He's in the back. And also another honored guest, we have the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Ward Ines. Ward, wave your hand there, Ward. Thanks for being here. All right. Before we go further with this, I would like to just talk about quickly what was happening in 1975. So here we go. The yearly inflation rate for 1975 was 9.2%. The year-end close of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 8.58. Interest rates on the Federal Reserve, 7.25%. The average cost of a new house, this is nationwide, $39,300. Average income, $14,100. Average monthly rent, $200. Cost of a gallon of gas, 44 cents. Average cost for a new car, $4,250. And Foster Grant sunglasses were $5. In the world, the oil price hit $13 per barrel. The unemployment rate in the U.S. reached 9.2%, and recession is recognized by President Ford. Jimmy Hoffa, ex-Teamster boss, disappears, never to be seen again, much like last year's Senate tax bill. There was construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Microsoft became a registered trademark. Bruce Springsteen put out Born to Run. Saturday Night Live debuted on NBC. Muhammad Ali beat Joe Frazier in The Thriller in Manila. Movies, Jaws, Young Frankenstein, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And a couple people that were born this year, 1975, Tiger Woods and Angelina Jolie. So there's a little bit about what happened in 1975. What we're going to do the rest of the way here is we have a short presentation from House Research staff on the property tax refund program, and then the Department of Revenue is going to talk a little bit about the program, and then we're going to hear from the dignitaries. We have a birthday card to sign, a resolution, and we're going to all eat cake after that point. So again, welcome everyone for being here. The House Research could, Nina Manzi is very good.
Good morning, Nina Manzi from the House Research Department. I'm going to go through and hit the high points of the stapled together handout that was in the members' packets. The program, as Chair Marquardt has noted, was enacted in 1975. It provides direct property tax relief to homeowners and renters. The refund was initially calculated using a unified schedule for homeowners and renters. The refund equaled taxes in excess of a threshold of income up to a maximum amount. So those are two concepts that are still in effect for the refund today, the income threshold and then the maximum refund amount. When initially enacted, the program did not have an income limit on eligibility. For renters, property taxes were set at 20% of rent paid. And for homeowners, there was an offset of the state-paid homestead credit from the refund amount that they initially calculated. So first you calculated your refund amount, then you subtracted the homestead credit, and then the net was what you received as the property tax refund. The first significant change occurred in 1977 when the concept of a co-payment was introduced. Prior to that time, the refund simply equaled taxes in excess of the threshold up to the maximum. After 1977, the applicant had to pay a percentage of taxes over the threshold up to the maximum. So that's a concept that's still in place today. In the early 1980s, there were several changes that were made in response to the budget situation at the time. First of those were that the refunds were shifted from being a credit that was claimed on the individual income tax return to being a separately filed claim that was paid in August for renters and September for homeowners. That had the effect of moving the cost of the program on a one-time basis across fiscal years. Another change in the 1980s were that the renter property tax refund shifted to being calculated based on the actual property tax paid on the rental units rather than as a percentage of rent paid. That had the effect of decreasing renter refunds overall. There also was put in place a maximum household income limit for eligibility at $40,000 for both homeowners and for renters. So the unified schedule remained in place, but you could only be eligible for a refund if your income was under $40,000. In 1988, probably the last piece of the refund as it's currently structured came into play, and that was the household income exclusion, which was allowed for senior and disabled claimants, and then a weighted exclusion was allowed for claimants who had dependents, with the exclusion decreasing in amount for the more dependents that you had. And that put things pretty much in the structure that we have today. In 1989, there were a lot of changes. The homestead credit was eliminated, so there was no more offset from the property tax refund amount. And as part of that, the maximum property tax refund decreased. So it looks like there was a big decrease from one year to the next in the maximum, but with the elimination of the homestead credit, the net property tax refund that people were eligible for really remained pretty much the same. The other thing that happened there is that the renter and homeowner schedules were split into two separate schedules like we have today. In 1993, both the income brackets and the maximum refunds for homeowners and renters began to be indexed for inflation. In 1997, the renter property tax refund shifted back to being calculated as a percent of rent paid. Then we didn't have many changes until the early part of, I guess, this decade, and there were some significant expansions of the homeowner refund where the maximum was increased in 2001 from $510 to $1,500, but you should note that that maximum only applies at very low income levels. And then it was increased again in 2008 to $2,300, and the income thresholds for homeowners were decreased to be at most 3.5% of income for eligibility. So that's the first page of the handout. The second two pages provide some historical data, the first for homeowners and the second for renters. I'll just hit some high points on these. On the homeowner sheet in that first table, you see that from 1985 to 1990, the maximum refund decreased significantly, and that has to do with the elimination of the homestead credit and then the scaling back of the homeowner refund schedule as a result of that. Another thing to note on the first table is that when you adjust the maximum income eligible from the earlier days of the program for inflation, you see that it really isn't that much lower than what the maximum is today. The maximum today is going to be just under $100,000 for 2010 refunds, but back in 1990, it was over $100,000 adjusted for inflation. So people think, well, it used to be $40,000, but that was quite a few years ago, and when you take inflation into account, it stayed about the same. The second table shows that in the first year of the refund, there was really a very high percentage of homesteads in the state that where the homeowners claimed the refund. It has dropped off after that, and part of what happened in the early years was that the homestead credit kept increasing from one year to the next. So more and more people found that they were ineligible for the property tax refund. In recent years, it's kind of flip-flopped between about 15% and about 20% of all homesteads in the state. On the back page of the homeowner sheet, there's a graph that compares property tax refund payments with residential homestead property taxes. Now, you need to note that the residential homestead property taxes are excluding the taxes on agricultural homesteads, which are difficult to pick apart. But these are on different scales. If the lines were exactly the same, it would mean that the property tax refund equaled about 10% of taxes. So you see that instead it's floated a little below 10% of taxes.
And Ms. Manzi, I've got a governor and a speaker and a lieutenant governor and tax chair. So we've got like 30 seconds.
Yep.
So let's keep them
second page
tight.
On the renter's final page. Here you see that the maximum income has decreased, has dropped off since the early years. But then you see it's held constant in recent years, and that's due to the indexing of the brackets. You also see in the second table that the percentage of rental units claiming the refund in early years was very high. That was due to the absence of an income limit on eligibility and also due to the high percentage of rent constituting property taxes. The back page shows a graph that shows you the inflation-adjusted value of the total renter property tax refund, and that has dropped off from the start of the program, and it dropped when it shifted to actual property taxes paid, and then it sort of leveled off when it shifted back to being a percent of rent paid. And that's all I have.
Ms. Manzi and all House Research, thank you so much. Just a wonderful summary of the history. Thank you.
You can have that.
Commissioner Reines from the Department of Revenue. The purpose today, of course, is to increase the publicity of this program, and that's been also a major goal of both the tax and the property tax committees and chairs. But I have to commend also the Department of Revenue, who you guys have just done a wonderful job of really promoting that, and we're seeing the rates go up on participation, and hopefully we get a lot more. But thank you very much, and Commissioner.
Right, Chairman Ward Ines from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and thank you for inviting me to the festivities. You know, I'm in the company here of the principal architects of one of the more enduring public policies we have in the tax arena. So it's been a permanent feature here for the last 35 years. And as you said, it has endured the test of time, which we can't say about some public policies. So it is refreshing, and it's one of those public policies too that's embraced by people of all political stripes. I mean, it's a one consensus item. We have one of the few, I think, this in this environment where all legislators of all political stripes embrace the program. And our job as a tax administrator is to elevate the profile of it, because our best data indicates that about a third of those that are eligible do not claim the refund. And so we have pulled out all the stops to try to elevate the profile, do a better job of marketing the program. You know, a couple of years ago, for the first time, we put on the individual income tax forms, a teaser, both on the front page and the back page, saying you may be eligible for this refund. Check it out, and gave them the website. We've made it the primary, one of the principal topics at our state fair booth. We've made it very prominently displayed on our web page. So we have tried to do everything we can. Our VITA sites, which are volunteer tax information sites, is prominently displayed. When you call us up and ask a question, if you're on hold, there's a message that goes, you should check out the property tax refund program. You may be eligible for this program. And I think, you know, what you've created here is really a best-of-class program. I recently looked at the Link Institute, did a side-by-side comparison of all the other states' property tax refund program. And any objective observer that looks at that can come to no other conclusion that Minnesota actually has the best of class when it comes to the property tax refund program. So it's our job to get the word out. And I think what I found in my informal survey at the State Fair when I bring this up to taxpayers is that they don't realize that if you have household income in excess of $75,000, you could still be eligible for this program. So I think we need to do a better job of saying, you know, this goes all the way up to $98,000 household income. It is a great program. You may have not qualified in previous years, but you should check it out. And so we've tried to do everything we possibly can. I think we handed out a packet that kind of gives a good synopsis of our marketing efforts, what we're doing to elevate the profile. If you have any suggestions about other ways we can penetrate the marketplace out there and try to get more people in tune to this really great program, we are willing to take any suggestions. But we're trying to elevate and make the footprint larger for this program. And just before I finish here, I want to give extended kudos to this committee, the two tax chairs, because they have been incredible protectors of this program. At a time of incredible scarcity in the budget, this program has not only maintained the status quo, it was enhanced in 2008, which is an incredible lift considering the circumstances we've been under. And there isn't always the taxpayer is a natural constituency for this, but that constituency isn't here in this room testifying on behalf of it. So it's really been the leadership of the property tax division and the tax committee that has said, you know what, this is good public policy, it works, we're not going to cut this program. In fact, in 2008, I thought it was an amazing accomplishment to enhance the property tax refund program. So any and all kudos are very much deserved by the two tax chairs.
Commissioner, thank you for those very nice comments. And only Commissioner Idness could talk about a teaser on the property tax thing. I've never heard that one before. So, and for anyone's, the numbers here and the website to get in here, I know a number of legislators also put this on their legislative reports. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
Go to our website. If you electronically file, you'll get the refund 30 days sooner than if you file by paper.
Thanks for the great work. All right, at this time we want to hear from those who were in the trenches at the time. And so with that, I would like to start with Governor Anderson. If you can.
First of all, I want to thank you for putting together this this event. And just speaking for myself, I really like attention. And I don't get much of it. And I read with interest Lori Sturdivant's article regarding the University of Minnesota the other Sunday. And when people talk about, it wasn't a Minnesotan, somebody else referred to what happened in 71. What happened in 71 made these other things possible. And what happened in 71, and I know, I hope there aren't legislators here because they might become nauseated and sick. We raised taxes. And every single person who voted for the tax increase was reelected. And across Minnesota for a six-year period of time, people's property taxes basically were frozen with the exception of inflation. We permitted inflation, but other than that, property taxes were frozen. The other thing that was frozen was tuition at the University of Minnesota. Now, the legislature and the governor do not control that, but I had contacts with the chairman of the board, Governor Elmer Anderson, and he and President Luce agreed that they would hold tuition in line if we at the state supported the university's budget, which we agreed to do. But when people talk about the tax bill of 71, and I the language wasn't strong enough. They referred to it as the Minnesota miracle, but it did so many other things that I really like. The idea was not mine. It came from somebody in Anoka County. We started a Right to Reap program. What was his name?
Weaver.
Pardon?
Weaver.
Now, he was the author, but the idea came from somebody else. And the Right to Read...
Erling Johnson?
Yes, Erling Johnson, the superintendent. At any rate, in Minnesota, when you talk about people that couldn't read, you think of young people coming into kindergarten that are underprepared and so forth. But what you don't realize that across Minnesota, as across the country, there were literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people out working who couldn't read. I'll give you a specific example. There's a carpenter, a machinist, I forget which, and he would get what he's supposed to do for the day, and he'd call his wife, and he'd spell out A, P, whatever it was, to find out what he's supposed to do. And but when we put together the Write to Read program, it became fashionable, might be a little strong, but entirely proper to go and get the education it took to learn to read. And that, and as I say, I know you're here on property taxes, but I feel very, very good about the Write to Read program, the fact we're able to freeze tuition. When I started the university, tuition was $27 a quarter. $27 a quarter. I know it was 1950, but a dollar was not a lot of money then. And it just enabled people with my kind of background. My mother and father had an eighth grade education, and my dad was a packing house worker. And I worked myself through and had the military, and then came back, went to law school. When I graduated in 1960, I didn't owe a dime to anybody other than a thank you to the taxpayers who made it possible. So I think when we talk about these things, I think it's also very legitimate to think of the other things that we did, which made Minnesota, in the minds of others, the state that works.
Thank you very much. Speaker Sable.
Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you all for the work you do on this program that started 35 years ago. And Wendy's right, what we did in 71 involved lots of important things. But the follow-up of the circuit breaker in 75 was a continuation of our concern over property taxes. But we had two things in mind. Previously, we had the homestead credit, which was exploding in cost and was not targeted. So we really had two things in mind. One was to make sure that the dollars we spent were targeted to the people who needed it the most, and at the same time to reduce the growth that was occurring in the old system. So it was both the equity issue and a budget issue to make dollars available for other things that the legislature might decide was important. It was really the result. As I recall, we had an interim commission on taxes that I think Alex served on and Bill served on, and we had the framework of a recommendation from that commission. Wendy had the recommendation for adopting. I've always called it the circuit breaker.
Yeah.
And in his budget message to us for that year, we made some revisions in that, and we passed it in the House under Kelly's leadership. We had very tough negotiations with the Senate, and our constant ally in the Senate was Alec Olson for adopting the circuit breaker. And after some tough negotiations, I have to tell you, I remember, I think that was a year that it was very tense of where we're going, and I got a call from the governor's office that Wendy wanted to have lunch with me. And I thought I was going to have great wisdom on how we're going to solve the specifics. And we went to the Lex and had lunch. And he said, "Don Martin, I want to give you two bits of advice. Get your rest, get your sleep, and get your exercise, and things will work out." Eventually, they did.
And I said, "Stop smoking."
Eventually that happened. So, but thank you, and thank you for the efforts of Wendy and Bill and Alex. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to go hear what the Senate had to say. President Olson.
I can't hardly remember back that far. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and everybody for coming. It's kind of a pleasure to get off of the farm back there in Canyuhai County and even walk through the building again. I've heard what the property tax and the research said about other states and their programs,
And all I kind of keep track of is like Florida and California. California did so many bad things back then that we used them often for, you know, making improvements in Minnesota. One of them was, and I digress here, but the administrative ability to take a driver's license. And as I see what's happening these days, I'd suggest people take a little look at that and find out why we aren't doing more removal of driver's license administratively for drunken driving offenses. But anyway, the program does work. It is good. I can't imagine how one could keep up with all that you've done, and I get lost in just your discussion of how it works and the amendments that have been made. I do want to point out that though I'm not a radical, it was a rather radical idea that we were working on, Martin, back then when we started, because we wanted to fold all tax relief into the circuit breaker. And I suggest that one of these days, maybe we'll find the great wisdom in that kind of an overhaul again. And I've long been an advocate of taking over full responsibility for education in Minnesota. And then we can let local governments loose. They can be on their own. We can improve our tax program and our policies and how we handle it all. We've got too many diverse claims on everything that happens, and we just have to try to look forward to unifying and getting back together. And the property tax program, refund program, as we've heard here this morning, has brought people together, and that's what can happen when we look at the whole and we get over some of the vested interests that seem to be running this country ragged these days. There are a lot of problems around. There's a lot of work for a lot of people to do. And I am so pleased that I'm here and that I can still take nourishment and keep track a little bit of what's going on and be a kind of a Monday morning quarterback and a nuisance back home, especially to my wife. I wish she was here today. But we thank you again and surely appreciate being here.
And thank you for being here. Of course, the person who always has to carry the water for leadership is the tax chair. And that still is true today. And Chair Kelly.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. This is a most unusual occasion when you think about it. And I want to be unusually grateful to a number of people who made this all possible, and touch on the property tax refund just for a bit. So I'll be rather brief. The first person I want to thank is Martin Sable, because he took a risk naming me chairman of the tax committee in 1975, and because of that, I became the author of House File 1674. Martin still wonders why he took that risk. So I owe him a great deal of gratitude and thanks. And then, sitting here today are three people who made us look very good in 1975 and still make you all look very good, and I'm grateful to them, and I'm sure you are too, and that's Karen Baker, and it's Steve Hines, and it's Joel Michael. They were staff in 1975. They were a little younger then and a little greener, but they were very good at that time, so you can imagine how good they are now. So you people are very fortunate, I think, to have that quality in the House Research Department, and not just them, but the other people in House Research as well. That's a great part of the organization for lots of reasons that we don't need to talk about today. What's a little funny for me here, and another unusual, is it's the 35th anniversary of the legislation, and I was 35 when I sponsored the bill, so it kind of reminded me that that was a few years ago. And I want to thank also Alec Olson on the Senate side, because he was very critical, and you heard what he had to say, and at that time his voice and his knowledge and his ability to work his colleagues in the Senate was critically important to getting this legislation passed. And so I'm grateful to Alec. And of course Wendy has done so much for the state, and this does spin in part out of the 71 Minnesota miracle, but also you should know, particularly on the Republican side, that there was a version of this that came out in 1967, and it was a renter's credit, at a very low rate. I think it was like 3% of income or something like that, 3% of tax or whatever. And it was a senior citizen refund that existed at that time. And that was under Republicans. So those of you who happen to be of that version, you know, you have some ownership of this as well. And so I was pleased to hear the commissioner say that this is really a nonpartisan, if you will, not just a bipartisan bill, it's a nonpartisan law that everyone seems to support. One of our big, and I'll close with this comment, one of our big concerns in 75 was how will people find out about this law and how many people will use it and what can we do to encourage people to use it. So when the commissioner spoke about the efforts today to make this opportunity available to those residents of our state who have the right to use this law to get a refund, are being strongly encouraged. And the public relations effort that you're making, Commissioner, I think is great. And I feel much better now knowing that there are more people who are able to use it, because that, again, was one of our primary concerns in 1975. And if you, those of you who have this sheet will note that in 77, we increased the amount available substantially, and it had to do a little bit with what Alec's talking about, but we never really told anybody. But that was the time of the energy crisis, and people were paying a lot more for fuel oil and all of those kinds of things. So even though we didn't talk about it, one of the reasons we increased the property tax refund a bit was to give people a little more cash so they could meet their fuel bills. We never said it to anybody, but that was part of the reason for so doing. So I think Alex is on point when he says that the property tax refund has some other possibilities, because there, it is important to recognize that there are some citizens in this state, residents in this state, who have contributed a great deal, who for whatever reason don't have the income they used to, and who need some assistance to get through whatever it is, the challenges that they're facing. So it could be taxes, property taxes raising because of changes in local aid, or God forbid, enactment of a TIF law. But the circuit breaker helps a little bit to pick up some of that additional pain, you know, that people feel given their particular circumstances. So thank you all so much for this opportunity to be here. We're most grateful.
And Speaker Sable had a thank you very much, Chairman.
Just a sidelight for all of you who are members now, not on taxes, but on your facilities. When we moved to the state office building away from the Capitol and developing offices here, the chair of the committee that was in charge of that move and deciding facilities and in the state office building was Bill Kelly.
So I hope you like it here.
and Chair Kelly, the excellent and hard work of the staff continues here on the taxes. Thank you for making note of that. I would like to now ask Tax Chair Lincheski, and I'd like to also call on Representative Lanning for a few comments. Chair Lincheski.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I feel just so honored to be in the room with all of you. And really, Commissioner, you as well, your comments, I think it should be noted. It's just a nice day when things are tough to think about what things are working well. And this is a program that is really working well. And it is doing so much for so many. And it is a very, very bipartisan program. I will recall just for you my short history here. You know, I've served under two tax chairs before I had the honor of Speaker Kelleher naming me the tax chair. And that was Representative Abrams and Representative Krinke, who both endorsed this program. Representative Abrams, a Republican, under Governor Ventura, dramatically increased this program. And Governor Pawlenty currently has continued to support this program and has been a strong advocate of individual payments within the property tax system to individuals. And so I think for the public, you know, why might everybody kind of agree on this? Because most people do. There are a few people, I guess, in the legislature who don't like the circuit breaker or PTR, however you choose to call it. But most do. And why is that? I mean, I think at its core, it really provides relief to folks for a very unfair tax that really is out of their control. It's not based on their ability to pay. So it allows it to be based on the ability to pay and progressive. And I think from more the conservative perspective, and I'll wait and hear what Representative Lanning has to say, but, you know, my observation watching my colleagues is people like things to be means tested. And that's exactly what this program is. It's not just for anybody at any income or for folks who have really low property taxes who are very lucky to be in that situation. It's really a based on your ability to pay progressive program. And I again, feel so honored to be with the folks who thought it up and had the leadership, really, to do it. We all think of good ideas. That doesn't mean they get through. So it really takes the guts and the leaders and the people who will say, you know, bring me the bill, I'll sign it, or let's get this through for the speaker, or let's get this out of the committee, or let's compromise, which is hard, let's compromise so we can get the votes to get it out of the committee. So it's really, I really thank you, Representative Marquardt, for having this event today and for inviting the dignitaries to be with us.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Another person who has championed the PTR program in all of his years in the legislature, Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our honored guests, it's a pleasure to have you with us. This program truly is supported across party lines, and there are many issues on which we disagree, but this is one program that we really feel is right for this state, for Minnesota. Those of us who are in office now can dream of the day when we can come before a body like this and talk about something that we did that was successful. And I'm sure you're gratified by the words you hear today about something you did 35 years ago and how much it's appreciated today. It's a dream for all of us that the work that we do here now as elected officials will be not only remembered, but will have a lasting impact. And this is a program that certainly has had that lasting impact. So thank you very much for being here. And Chair Kelly, I'd like to second your comments about the staff. I'm incredibly impressed by the competence of our staff that have served this body for so many years, and all of the good work that we do, that you did, in large part is due to the quality of work that has been provided to us by the staff. And so thank you very much. And Chair Marquardt, Chair Lincheski, thank you for your leadership.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. I'm going to give the governor the last word.
Well, this year is also the 77th year of the Minnesota Progressive Income Tax, which was passed in March of 1933 at the height of the Depression. Can you imagine what the critics would say, must have said at that time to these goofy farmers and legislators that put in a income tax when there's incredible unemployment? But you know, they must have been done something right, because during World War II, when we had the draft, and for those of you who are young, men were drafted to serve in the war, and we no longer have the draft. And the of the 48 states, Minnesota had the fewest rejections for reasons of education or health. One might argue that there is a correlation between the commitment that people make to public education and good results.
Thank you. And for all of our four honored guests, we have a House resolution for each of them that I would like to read. A House resolution commemorating 35 years of the Property Tax Refund Program and Renters Credit Program. Whereas the Property Tax Refund Program and Renters Credit Program were enacted into law in 1975 by the Minnesota Legislature in order to provide property tax relief based on the ability to pay. And whereas the Property Tax Refund and Renters Credit Programs are the most progressive tax relief programs in our state and help relieve the burden of property taxes on homeowners. And whereas in 2008, the program Property Tax Refund, 360,000 households received funds totaling $270 million with an average refund of $746. And the Renters Credit Program, 304,000 renters received refunds totaling $180 million with an average refund being $591. And whereas the property tax refund and the renter's credit program have continued to be a model of public policy throughout the last 35 years and has remained sustainable, and whereas under the leadership, vision, and perseverance of Governor Wendell Anderson, Speaker of the House Martin Olof Sabel, President of the Senate Alec Olson, and Tax Chair of the House of Representatives William Kelly, the income-adjusted homestead credit program, later renamed the property tax refund program and renter's credit program, came into being. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives, State of Minnesota, that congratulates the property tax refund program and the renter's credit program on their 35 years of benefiting homeowners and recognizes the accomplishments of Governor Wendell Olson, Wendell Anderson.
That's what I looked at both of you there.
I don't mind Olson.
Governor Wendell Anderson.
I wouldn't like Sable. He's a Norwegian.
Speaker of the House Martin Olof Sable, President of the Senate Alec Olson, and Tax Chair of the House of Representatives William Kelly, and all others in its creation. Let's give all of these people, everyone who has something to do with it. And finally, we have a birthday card to be signed as you come forward. And I'm just going to read the limerick that is here. It is a happy 35th birthday to these programs. Best wishes for many more years to come. It's been 35 years since this bill passed. With a leap of faith, this vote was cast. But over the years, the case has been made why this program will last. Happy 35th birthday, and then I would like, first of all, the four of you to sign this. We'll put it over there, and then everyone else, as you get cake, can also sign that. Again, thank you all, and another 100 years or 35 for this program. So thank you.
Thank you very much.